Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning, I'm Janice Shortle. This is NPR News. I'm in for Carrie Miller. This morning, we're going to talk about, well, something we all just did, sleep. It's a problem for many people. About half of us aren't getting enough sleep. In 2014, the National Sleep Foundation found that some 45% of Americans said poor or insufficient sleep had affected their daily activities at least once in the past week. And then there are actual sleep disorders: insomnia, sleep apnea, sleepwalking, sleep paralysis, hypersomnia, nightmares, snoring. Millions of Americans suffer from chronic long-term sleep disorders. 40 million of us each year, with another 20 million of us handling occasional sleep problems. So what is going on? Why do we struggle so much with sleep? What can we do to make our sleep better? Why is sleep so important to our lives? What's really going on in our brains and in our bodies when we are asleep? We want to hear from you to answer those questions. Do you struggle with insomnia? Do you struggle with sleep apnea? Do you have a partner who snores? Do you have questions about dreams? If you have a question about any of this, please give us a call, 651-227-6000, or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. Here to help answer some of these questions are two sleep experts. In studio, Dr. Michael Howell is an expert in parasomnia, bizarre and potentially dangerous sleep disorders. He's a professor at the University of Minnesota's Department of Neurology. He joins me today, like I said, in studio here in St. Paul. Welcome to you, Michael.
Hi, Jenna.
Thanks for coming in today. Also chiming in with us is Dr. Viga Kaufman. She's a licensed clinical psychologist and instructor in psychology and neuroscience at the University of Colorado Boulder. She joins us from Boulder, Colorado. Viga, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. All right. So we've just come off some sleep relatively recently, so we should be fresh to talk about this. Michael, the big question, we'll start with you. How important is sleep to our daily existence?
All organisms sleep. We spend a third of our lives doing it, so it's critically important for brain and body health.
And what happens to our brain and body when we're asleep?
That's a good question. We are just starting to unravel the mysteries of why we sleep. Sleep helps prune unnecessary connections in our brain. Our brain builds up toxins throughout the course of the day, and sleep helps wash it away. When you want to learn something, it's when you're sleeping that you're learning it. If you need to remember something from 20 years ago, it's when you're sleeping that your brain replays these memories so that you're more likely to recall them. When we wake up, we're more alert, refreshed, less likely to fall asleep at work and while driving.
Okay, now we're going to go to Viga on this one, because I want to know what happens when we're sleeping, if we're doing all these things. Why do people have such problems getting to sleep, staying asleep, or having sleep be their friend if all these great things are happening? Like Dr. Howell just pointed out.
It's amazing, because we feel so refreshed when we get a good night of sleep. But I think that modern day society and the pace that we maintain throughout our lives, you know, it used to be a badge of honor to deprive ourselves of sleep. In fact, human beings are the only people who willingly deprive themselves of sleep. And then what ends up happening is we end up feeling our mood gets worse, we grow irritable, and yet we don't necessarily tether those types of things to depriving ourselves of sleep. And we start having a bad relationship with our beds. We start dreading going to sleep if we were deprived of it. And then we also start questioning our ability to sleep, which leads to a lot of hyperarousal. And that's the exact opposite state we want to be in when we're trying to promote some restorative sleep.
Yeah, I like that you brought up that badge of honor part. Every time I read an article about a person in power, they always reference that they only sleep 3 to 5 hours per night, like somehow, and they're making really big decisions.
I know. I'm generally unimpressed when I hear that people stayed up throughout the night trying to hash out some really important decisions.
Viga is right. The best thing you can do if you have a challenging puzzle that you're trying to work through is get a good night's sleep on it.
I've just read something this morning about that our mind actually really does sharpen after Is it REM sleep or REM sleep?
Well, both stages. So there's just a quick review of sleep. Sleep is not a deeply homogeneous state. We go through different stages and cycles about every 90 minutes. And during these different stages of sleep, our brain is doing different things. It's, as mentioned, cleaning out toxins. It's pruning excessive connections. It's then amplifying the important memories that we need. And it is during REM sleep when we're dreaming most vividly, when our memories to a large degree are being amplified, the ones that are particularly relevant.
And what should we make of those, that vivid part of what happens to us when we're sleeping?
I think my interpretation, and I'd be curious what Dr. Kaufman's impression is my interpretation of REM sleep and dreams is that this is our brain recognizing the process by which our brain is taking experiences in our life that are emotionally intense, and then replaying them because emotions are our brain's way of assigning meaning to experiences. So if you nearly had a car accident this morning, you are very likely to dream about that because it's quite important to remember to be very careful taking a left on a unprotected green light, for example.
Interesting. So it'll come back to you at night, but sometimes in a different form, right?
Your appreciation of your own dreams is kind of like a computer recognizing its own file compression. So it doesn't completely necessarily make a lot of sense. We'll have dreams of different relationships with people in our life. Somebody we just met today is all of a sudden at a cocktail party with cousins from 30 years ago, and that's our brain trying to make sense of these relationships.
Yeah, what's interesting about dreaming too is, you know, as Michael pointed out, we're still really learning about what exactly is going on and what the functions of dreams are. We know that when people learn a new task, for example, if they're learning something new, or even animal models of learning, we know that when a novel task is learned, people tend to spend more time in REM sleep. But we don't know if that's the learning piece of people actually consolidating memories, or maybe even just the stress of learning a new task, or both. So it's with dreaming, we also know there are some medications that suppress REM sleep, which doesn't necessarily mean you're suppressing dreaming. And we know that people who are on those types of medications don't necessarily have deficits in learning and memory.
Interesting. Well, I think a lot of things that we talk about or we have been talking about so far have to do with adults, but kids are in this equation too. They sleep as well. And we have a call from Molly in Northfield who has a specific question about her child and what's going on when her child sleeps. Molly, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
So I have a teenager who suffers from PTSD and has nightly traumatic nightmares. And we've been working on trying to get into a routine with allowing him to be able to have the best sleep possible, but we're still really dealing with some issues. So he's had a sleep study, and we've got a pretty good routine for sleep hygiene, if you will. And he is taking some medication called Prazosin, but we're still really struggling on a nightly basis. So just wondering if you've got any recommendations.
Dr. Howe?
Sure. So, Molly, I'm sorry that your teenager is going through that. So just to review, post-traumatic stress disorder commonly has sleep problems. Most notably is what's happening is that they're taking these traumatic experiences they've had in their lives, and as their brain is replaying these experiences, they're replaying them every single night to a point which is not helpful. It's actually harming, and that's why the medication Prazosin can sometimes be helpful because it can suppress some of those intense dreams. The first thing I always take a look at, Molly, is especially in teenagers, is first recognizing what the underlying individual sleep-wake cycle is. This is our 24-hour circadian rhythm. This is our everything. Every experience in our body operates on a 24-hour clock. And the first thing to recognize is that we need to sleep when our bodies naturally want us to sleep, or at the very least understand when that is. So one of the first questions we would explore when trying to get to the bottom of this is, when does one naturally want to fall asleep and when does one naturally want to wake up? And when this gets misaligned, when we try to fall asleep too early, for example, this can leave us to have troubles falling asleep, and then when we wake up, we're not refreshed. It also tends to lead to have our dreams more vivid and distressing.
Interesting. We have another call from Mike in Minneapolis who has a little bit of a sleep mystery question. I'll give this one to Dr. Kaufman, but I'll let Mike chime in. Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Why don't you go ahead and ask your question for us?
Okay, so I had a sleep study for apnea, and during the sleep study, rather than have the single line, I kept going from wide awake to deep sleep, wide awake to deep sleep, fast enough that it was a solid bar between the two. I never really got a explanation of it, and I was wondering what you thought of that or if you've ever seen it. The guy that did the sleep study had never seen it before.
That sounds like an interesting phenomenon. I haven't heard of that before. What I've heard more of is people regularly waking up approximately every hour and a half to 2 hours, which would be more of the going into lighter stages of sleep and experiencing that as an awakening. But what you're, and oftentimes with sleep apnea, that often occurs during REM sleep. So when people are paralyzed and are more difficult to arouse and they'll wake themselves up with a gasp. But what you're talking about in terms of that dichotomy of going between deep sleep and wakefulness, I actually haven't seen before.
One thought, Mike, that your story brings up is that there is a neurotransmitter in the brain called orexin, which is lost in people who have narcolepsy. Now, I'm not saying that you have narcolepsy, but the fascinating aspect of this neurotransmitter is that once you are awake, it helps keep you awake. And the same system, once you are asleep, it helps keep you asleep. So you don't want to be stuck in the revolving door between wake and sleep. And sometimes for people who have a condition similar to narcolepsy, that's what happens.
So it's just instantaneous almost. They go back and forth to each, and it can be confusing.
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, if you ever woken up from a nap where you woke up too early, imagine living like that 24 hours a day.
I can't imagine. So let's talk a little bit about that. You know, when we're talking about sleep, not getting enough sleep or not getting the right kind of sleep, there can be real health problems, perhaps depression, weakened immune system, stuff like that. When do we get to that point? How much sleep do we need to avoid those things?
So most people need somewhere between 7 to 8 hours of sleep. But what's really important is recognizing what the ideal timing for your sleep is. If you're an individual if the whole world would let you, you'd go to bed at midnight and wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning. Just because you go to bed at 10 and wake up at 6 doesn't mean your sleep is going to be ideally refreshing for you. And so you need to recognize first, know yourself, know what your natural underlying sleep timing is. And then using bright light in the morning, like giving yourself a sunrise, for example, that you can help move that natural timing around so that you get a good ideal amount of sleep.
Dr. Kaufman, you've talked a lot about cognitive behavioral therapy as a treatment for some sleep disorders. Chime in on that.
Sure. So actually, we're celebrating the 1-year anniversary of the American College of Physicians putting out their clinical guidelines saying that cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia should be the first line treatment for insomnia. And what that means is that there are different ways that you can change your body's, recalibrate your body's ability to sleep through behavioral change. And with cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, kind of does, I like to think of it as a behavioral autopsy. It tries to figure out what people are thinking, doing, the choices they're making that might actually be perpetuating some of their sleep problems.
Interesting. Well, I've just got to let you both know, Dr. Kaufman and Dr. Howell, we're getting a lot of calls from people that are all over the map. So I'm going to be kind of hopscotching around here, if you don't mind. So we're going to take a call from June in St. Louis Park. She has a very specific question. Hi, June.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had heard, if you want to revisit sleep apnea for a second, I had heard there was a connection between sleep apnea and AFib. Could you address that? Is there a conclusive connection between the two?
Right. So AFib is atrial fibrillation. It's an abnormal heart rhythm. And if you have obstructive sleep apnea, particularly severe obstructive sleep apnea, it increases your risk for atrial fibrillation as well as other cardiovascular diseases, including stroke.
Okay. So enough to warrant getting a sleep study if you think you're at risk of it?
If the reasons for getting evaluated with a sleep study include if you snore, if you've had trouble breathing at night, if you're overweight, or if you have uncontrolled high blood pressure.
All right, we have another question. I'm glad you brought up the very, very sensitive topic of snoring. Snoring seems to be one that always comes up when we talk about sleep. And Chad in Minneapolis has a specific question about that, and he's looking for a miracle solution. So who should take that? Dr. Kaufman, do you think you'll have a miracle solution about the next question?
A miracle solution. Well, I'll give it a shot.
All right, Chad, what's your question?
Basically, you know, just that. I've done a study that determined whether or not I needed to do a sleep study, and that came out negative. I have a pretty heavy snore, always have, and an upcoming move is going to put me and the wife in the same bedroom. So, you know, I've looked into procedures and options. I definitely don't want to wear a mask while I sleep, but I also don't really feel like getting the soft palate of my mouth lined with polyester quartz either. So curious if you
right.
have any other solutions.
You know, what some people find surprising is that there's something called dental sleep medicine, and there might be somebody in your neck of the woods who could take a piece to take a look at your mouth and see if you would be a good candidate for what's called a mandibular advancement device. And that's something that kind of looks like a retainer that brings the bottom part of your jaw a little bit forward so that the consequence being that it opens up your airway so you're able to breathe more efficiently in the nighttime. It's less invasive than a CPAP, and it can really be useful. Beyond that, the miracle might be some earwax for your wife.
Thank you for chiming in with the miracle cure. I really do appreciate you. And I appreciate everybody that's calling in and asking questions. If you want to call in and you have a question about sleep or dreams or anything specific to those topics, please do so. You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. Dr. Kaufman, something was just brought up that I think a lot of people use to try and sleep, and those are medications to sleep. And I'm not just talking about prescriptions. I'm talking about the everyday co-op melatonin. Is that a bad thing?
So, you know, so melatonin is a timing. It's a timing hormone, and a lot of times people really equate melatonin with just simply the timing of sleep. So melatonin goes up in all creatures, great and small, in response to the dark. Melatonin says, do what you do when it's dark outside. So for nocturnal creatures who are going to go on the hunt, they're going to go eat. For human beings, that means it's our time to sleep. If people are looking with circadian disorders where the timing of the release of melatonin is perturbed, sometimes people think that taking a supplement would be useful. Really, nothing influences the on and offset of melatonin like light exposure. So that would be the first place where I would look, is to see what people's light exposure is, especially in the evening. A lot of times also, melatonin, you really need a small dose. It's, you know, the research is kind of patchy on the magnitude of the effect it's going to have. A lot of times research studies use 3 milligrams or less, and in the store you're seeing 5 to 10 milligram doses, which are just massive. So it's you can give it a try. I would make sure to consult with people to figure out timing, usually taking it a few hours before your desired sleep onset is best, but nothing's better than just changing your behaviorally what your exposure to light is, especially in the morning.
Is melatonin something that you can be addicted to? You'll need it to sleep after a certain period of time?
No, it actually looks like it has a pretty good safety profile. The biggest pieces with it is, one, you're spending money that you probably don't have to. Two is that we don't know what it does long term to take something exogenously, to get something from the outside. Does your body in any way adapt? It doesn't look like it does, but there's no, it does not have addiction potential.
All right, interesting.
So just a comment about insomnia. So nobody ever laid awake in a dark room and stared at the ceiling and thought about how great their life is. It's a very stressful experience, and that it's not unusual that they then go and search for anything, prescription medication, over the counter. The answers are really often paradoxical. If you have trouble falling asleep, but you also have trouble waking up in the morning, as Dr. Kaufman mentioned, this is a timing of sleep problem, not necessarily an insomnia problem, and you focus on working on your light. If, on the other hand, you have trouble falling asleep at night, but 6 o'clock in the morning, the alarm goes off, you might be tired, but you're able to pop out of bed, the hands-down best therapy, as Dr. Kaufman mentioned, is cognitive behavioral therapy, which can really be, I'll let Dr. Kaufman explain it in more detail, but the two cardinal rules are you do not go to bed if you are not sleepy, and if you are not allowed to sleep outside of the bedroom.
Interesting. You want to chime in on that one, Doctor?
Sure. You know, it's the principles around cognitive behavioral therapy really date back to Pavlov and Skinner. So a lot of the things happen where we build an association where bed ends up being a place for thinking, worrying, checking our email, watching Netflix, etc. When really bed should be a place where sleep takes place. When you go to bed, your body and your mind, whether or not you're it's deliberate, it's thinking, what are we doing tonight? Are we worrying? Are we planning our revenge? Are we planning tomorrow? Or are we watching TV? When really what your mind should have a singular focus, which is we are going to be sleeping in bed tonight. So with some repetition, and it doesn't take too long, is that if you are asleep, you are in bed. And if you are awake, you're out of bed. And that's simply one component called stimulus control that really draws on some of the learning theory that of Pavlovian conditioning.
Interesting. We have a call coming in from Bianca. She's in Minneapolis. She has a very specific question about what's going on in her world, and I haven't heard about this one that much, so I'll let Bianca take it from here. Bianca, are you there?
Yep.
All right, what's your question?
Hello?
Yeah, hello.
I was recently diagnosed with idiopathic hypersomnia, and I've tried every treatment, medication, natural remedy under the sun, and nothing helps. So I was just wondering if you had any advice or anything else to try. I get plenty of exercise. I have a really specific healthy diet. And I mean, like I said, I tried the stay awake drugs, everything like that. So I'm kind of at a loss for what else to do.
Bianca, I'm sorry you're going through this. So idiopathic hypersomnia is the diagnosis we give people when, quite frankly, we don't have a better explanation for why they are tired or sleepy. And a lot of people fall into this category. I was just at a meeting in Boston last Friday where we talked about this very topic. The approach that I take in individuals like this is to go back to the very beginning, look at fundamentally recognizing what in an individual's 24-hour wake-sleep state would be. Take someone on a thought experiment. If I could send you to Hawaii or some other paradise for 3 months, all expenses paid, you didn't need to worry about work, significant others, kids, pets, nothing. And your only job was to figure out what is the natural time for you to go to bed at night and when is the natural time for you to wake up. Now, first of all, we often would say, most people with idiopathic hypersomnia would say they'd sleep all the time. And I understand that sentiment, but usually what would happen after a few days, your body would fall into a typical rhythm. Once you recognize what that rhythm is, you can then start trying to move that rhythm around, again, using bright light, particularly in the morning, to move it to where you would like it to be. And then typically sleep starts to get better. That being said, this is a very challenging condition. There are numerous studies ongoing trying to look at new novel therapies to get to the bottom of this, because you're right, Bianca, conventional stimulant medications is not going to be the answer here.
Let's take a hard left here. We'll still stay in the sleep mode, but let's talk a little bit, because we talked about in the beginning of the show, about dreams. Why? You talked a little bit about why we dream and what's happening in our brains when we dream. A lot of people have questions of, the big one is, why do I keep having the same dream? What is the point of recurring dreams?
So just to reorient ourselves, so dreams, at least the vivid dreams when we usually think about dreaming, occurs during REM sleep. REM sleep stands for rapid eye movement sleep. It is an absolutely fascinating condition. It was discovered about 50 years ago, and it was recognized that brainwave activity looks identical to when we are awake, yet an individual or an animal is clearly behaviorally sleeping. And so what that means is that there is a process inside the brain that is activating wake-like memories, but this is internally generated. Now, we don't look like we're awake because there's an active process paralyzing all of your muscles. That's normal. So if you've ever picked up a young child who's sleeping and they're floppy like a rag doll, they're not just relaxed. That is, they're in REM sleep and their brainstem is paralyzing them. So these dreams happen in REM sleep. They are reamplification of emotionally laden memories. So if you've had an experience that is emotionally intense, your brain will replay this. And if that it is particularly intense, it's more likely to get caught into the circuit. I am 43 years old. I've been out of college for a long time, but I still have, you could call it a nightmare, I suppose, but I still have dream fragments where I wake up feeling like I'm 10 minutes late for that critical final that got me into medical school.
It keeps happening.
Yes.
So, okay, you have one too. The expert has one too. I feel better about this. Dr. Kaufman, I'm curious. I've had someone ask me this, to ask this question. A person who is having these kinds of dreams, who's dreaming at night and working out problems in his or her head, is that giving her or him better sleep, or does the sleep part and the dream part, they're separate?
Well, that's a great question. I think that in when emotions and repetition about certain topics visit us in our dreams, we're probably not spending enough time during the day processing them ourselves. There is, you know, during the day, we're incredibly busy. We're going. And the first time often that we're alone with our thoughts is when we're in our bedroom, in our bed, and it's quiet, and all we have to pay attention to is what's happening in our minds. So why wouldn't our minds lead us to things that we kind of want to spend some time thinking about? So I'm not sure that I would say that it impacts the quality of your sleep unless you notice that it's impacting the quality of your sleep the next day, feeling as if it was a fitful sleep. But one way to see whether or not your sleep can be improved is to really take time, maybe an hour or two before going to sleep, to just sit with your own thoughts and to kind of rehash the day or just give a little bit of airtime to some of your preoccupations.
Fascinating. So this can actually help us work through some problems while we're
sure.
We're going 24/7. So the people bragging about just sleeping 4 hours, we can do it too. We'll just do it while we're resting. Interesting.
Right.
Fascinating stuff. I want to know specifically too, we've had two people call on this. When you fall asleep and you're having a dream and it wakes you up and then you go get a glass of water and then you go back to sleep, the same dream starts over again. You're still in that dream. How does it keep happening? Is your brain just stuck there?
Well, your mind, some circuits in your brain have already started down a plot line, and you'll frequently go right back into it if the duration of your arousal is fairly short.
Interesting. Terry is calling in from St. Louis Park, and he's talking a little bit about, well, sleeping and talking. Terry, you there?
Yes. The problem I seem to have that's it doesn't happen a lot, but when it does, it's very disturbing if I have a friend sleeping over, because I tend to wake up during a violent dream, and I don't just shout or briefly shriek or do something real short. I tend to go into a real long, violent, vulgar-languaged lecture to whatever threat I'm having in the dream. And I'll go on for quite a while, and I usually have to be shaken awake to be told that I'm talking in my sleep, and usually it's kind of talking real loud and not really necessarily reacting to a death threat or anything, but I'm usually just doing a real lecture type, but one that's really intense and emotionally charged. And I just wonder, is there any way one can kind of stop doing that? Or because, like I say, it doesn't happen with every dream, but certain ones, and when it does, it always seems like when I'm with my friend on vacation and we're in one room in a hotel, and then that's when it disturbs.
Interesting question, Terry. Dr. Howell, any advice?
Yes. So you have a parasomnia, which is an abnormal behavior that occurs out of sleep. There are a large number of parasomnias that this could be. One that it might be is actually a condition that we used to refer to as the Minnesota disease, because it was discovered here at Hennepin County Medical Center back in 1982. As we were talking before about REM sleep, we're dreaming, but we're also paralyzed. But there is a condition that particularly affects us, usually as we get older, usually in our 40s or 50s, sometimes later, where we'll lose that paralysis. So whatever you're dreaming, you start acting out. So if you're dreaming you're playing baseball, you're jumping out of bed. If you're dreaming you're being chased by a bear, you will thrash, punch, kick. This is not unusual. It affects about a half of 1% of the population. That means in the state of Minnesota, there are at least 25,000 people who have this condition. It is absolutely an identifiable disorder and treatable.
Wow, that's interesting. Dr. Kaufman, I'm going to give this next one to you. This is from Mary in Farmington, and she's talking about something that I hear a lot about in my industry. I'm in television, so it's a 24-hour industry. And Mary from Farmington, I'll let you go ahead and ask your question for Dr. Kaufman.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My husband is a he works overnight. He gets home at about 7:30 in the morning. And, you know, he maybe gets to sleep by 8 or 9, and he sleeps for maybe about 5 hours a day. And then, he naps at night before he goes back into work for about an hour or so after dinner. But then on the weekends, he thinks that he needs to recoup all those hours that he's missed by sleeping extended periods of time. And I'm just wondering if, you know, the sleeping 10, 12 hours at a time is actually doing good for him, or if it's hurting him more.
That's an excellent question, Mary. So what's happening with your husband is he does some shift work, and what ends up happening with working during our evening hours is our circadian rhythm grows a little bit confused. And so there's a circadian issue, but also there's sleep loss. So he's accumulating a sleep debt. And of course, it probably feels good for him to try to recoup some of that sleep on the weekends. He would probably, whether or not that's harmful, I don't think one, that we know, and two, I doubt it. I think, however, what he might find more satisfying is trying to get more sleep during the week. So you said that he takes a nap before work. Can he extend that nap so he has kind of more of a biphasic sleep, or have 2, maybe 4 hours of chunks of sleep each day? He might actually even be contributing just to his sleep preoccupation by getting all that sleep on the weekends and not doling it out a little bit more evenly throughout the week. It doesn't look like we actually ever fully get back, pay off that sleep debt. So being a little bit more consistent during the week is probably his best bet.
All right. Thanks for that. You're listening to NPR News. I'm Janice Shortle filling in for Carrie Miller. You know, we're talking to Dr. Michael Howell and Dr. Vika Kaufman about sleep. If you have trouble sleeping or you have any questions about this topic, feel free to give us a call, 651-227-6000 or toll-free 1-800-242-2828. Want to bring you up to speed on some news out of Washington, D.C. FBI Director James Comey is testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee today in Washington. Senators are asking Comey about the investigation of Russia's role in the 2016 presidential election and how his probe into Hillary Clinton's emails might have affected the last days of her campaign. We'll have updates on this story throughout the day on NPR News, and you can hear and watch the testimony live right now at nprnews.org. Let's get back to sleep. Let's talk a bit, because we haven't really touched on this. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are parents and kids with sleep. We know how kids are supposed to get a certain amount of sleep, 8-9 hours. Is that the gold standard, or if they're taking naps, or what would we like to hit there? Dr. Kaufman, I'll let you go first.
Well, it depends on how old your child is. I think that there are a few things to kind of to keep in mind here. One is that our sleep needs change, throughout the lifespan. And it looks like newborns, infants, they're sleeping up to 18 hours a day. When you get to toddlers, kids, maybe up to 12 years old, you're seeing maybe 11, 12, 13 hours a day. With teenagers on average, going upward 9 to 11 hours. And what ends up being normal for any individual at any point in the lifespan is daytime functioning. So sleep quality is, I think, something that people don't pay as much attention to as sleep quantity. People really want a certain number of hours of sleep. But you could have 12 hours of light sleep, and that's, we call that popcorn sleep. You can live off popcorn, but it's not going to be very satisfying. What you really want is some sleep continuity. So, yes, there are some guidelines about how many hours of sleep your kids should be getting, and having that be in one continuous chunk so that they can, learn and play and engage with their friends is going to be really quite important.
Interesting. This is something that I did as a teenager. Greg from Minneapolis is calling about it, and I'm curious to see what your answer to his question is. We just have a couple minutes left. So, Greg from Minneapolis, why don't you go ahead and ask your question for Dr. Howell?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. So I've always been a night owl, but for the past year, I've found that I've been procrastinating sleep, where the point where I can be almost passing out, and I still stay up and just make this really bad decision that corresponds and has a downward effect through, my job as a manager and my single father. It just kind of ruins my whole life. So I'm trying to figure out how the heck I can stop being stupid and procrastinating sleep at night.
Right. Well, Greg, thank you for sharing that story. It's certainly very common. What you're describing is a challenge with sleep timing that we've been talking quite a bit about today, which is that if the whole world would let you, you'd go to bed later and sleep in later. Of course, the world doesn't let you, nor do children let you do that. The first step is to recognize where your natural sleep schedule would be. You can't fix this before you understand yourself. After you do that, you then use bright light, particularly in the morning, to start advancing that natural sleep time. So instead of just throwing numbers out here, instead of naturally going to bed at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and waking up at 10, with bright light consistently in the morning, you can start going to bed naturally at midnight and waking up at 8 or 9. And you just kind of use that pattern to start moving forward. The problem with this, Greg, is that you're capable of sleeping. You're just sleeping in the wrong time zone. So the trick is just to put you on the right place on this planet.
Dr. Coffin, we've got about 40 seconds left. Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I think that there was a recent study coming out of the University of Colorado Boulder that suggested that going camping for a week and going to bed when the sun goes to bed and getting up with the sun might actually help reset people's circadian rhythm.
Excellent. I've been wanting to go test out that study for myself. I'm still pitching it to the boss, so we'll see if it gets through. That's all the time we have. I want to thank Dr. Vega Kaufman. She's with the psychology and neuroscience sector at the University of Colorado Boulder. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you, Jana. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks. And thanks to Michael Howell, Associate Professor, Department of Neurology at the University of Minnesota. He's the Medical Director at the Fairview Sleep Services in Edina.
Thank you.